Session number 20970, Reel 3.
Reel 3.
I don't recall clearly, but it was some kind of a lorry which was to take us to this factory in the 10th Bezirk, the 10th district of Vienna, a factory which turned out to be called Ostmarkwerke. But before we could reach the place, an air raid occurred. And this was somewhere in Vienna. We thought of finding shelter under some bridge, only to be told that that was unsafe because they were bombing the bridges. I also remember that my mother was, who was, like I told you, in my childhood, the tower of strength. She was completely undone by air raids and by these adversities. I was the stronger one of the two. She tried to shelter me, whereas I was interested to see what was going on. I wanted to experience instead of burying my head in her lap, which is what she wanted me to do. Anyhow, there was this air raid, and then we continued on our journey. My father being carried in some kind of a makeshift sling on my... my father carrying, I beg your pardon, carrying my baby cousin on his back, and us taking turns to carry the other baby of the family, little George. When we arrived in this factory, we found that there was a 5-floor building, of which the ground floor and the 4th and 5th floor were used for factory purposes, and the 2nd and 3rd floors were for the Jewish people to live in. Of course, the warmest places, the ones furthest from the blown-out windows, were already taken by those who were there. There were some people who went there directly in the summer, and we arrived late November. We had to take whatever places were left, and whatever little local privileges were to be had were no longer available to us because the camp hierarchy had already been established by the time we arrived. The regime was similar, that you had to be officially 14 to work and get rations. The grandmothers were definitely out. They couldn't do any work, whereas in the agricultural camp, they were given the occasional job. And the food was worse even than in the agricultural camp. There was an aspect of a certain kind of food which I thought I had almost forgotten until recently. We bought some vegetable stock cubes, and suddenly the smell hit me. They gave you what was called Dörgemüse. It was a kind of stew made up of dried vegetables. Whether they dried the vegetables wrong, did they cook the vegetables wrong, did they allow it to go half rotten, I cannot tell you. But no matter how hungry, how starved we were, it was inedible. Quite often, the food which was given us was bad, giving the camp food poisoning. The camp itself, I mean, it's a flat, try to envisage it's a factory floor with bunk beds lined up in rows. And there was, as you entered from the staircase on the right hand side, there was a kind of washroom area. There were some water taps, but there were no lavatories for some reason. Instead, there were containers, and these containers were to be taken down the stairs by some Jews whose work assignment this was. This was not a pleasant arrangement at the best of times, but when the whole camp had food poisoning, that doesn't really bear description. The cold was intensive. Vienna is has an inclement climate, very hot and very cold and very wet in rotation, and the floor was not the factory area where we slept wasn't properly heated, and blankets we hardly had. Although I preserved the regulation grey blanket that each person was given at Strasshof, I have got one upstairs, and sometimes my grandchildren play on it in the garden. It tells you something about the German efficiency that more than half a century later, and much after much use later, the blanket is still intact. It's not frayed, it's not worn, it's still there. But a thin grey blanket didn't keep the cold out much, and something had to be done. Well, there's a friend of mine who lives not far from here, whom I first got to know there in the camp. He, like I, pretended to be older than he was. In fact, he was 13 at the time. Very inventive, very agile, a born engineer, and he became an engineer, trained to be, and an eminent engineer at that. And during air raids, which were quite regular by that time, during air raids, nobody could move. You had to be down in the cellars. And if anybody was caught moving about during the air raid, they shot you first. There were guards making sure that during air raids there was no movement anywhere in the factory. Nevertheless, he risked his life occasion by occasion, stealing blackout curtains from the buildings of the factory buildings during the air raids. And my grandmother made the blackout curtains up into clothing. The Germans realized, the Austrians realized that the curtains were missing. But the whole arrangement was ingenious enough. It was all cut up, it was already sewn before the thing could have been tracked down. It was worn underneath other clothing which we had. So there was this sort of clandestine arrangement between one of the youngest members of the camp, my friend, and one of the oldest members, my grandmother, who were trying systematically to help the clothing, which was so by then so inadequate. These were, you see, clothes that we managed to bring with us on our backs from the ghetto where we started from in the height of the summer. And by now it was the dead of winter. And by then it had gone through the work experiences that we had. The clothing had its own experiences. And the clothing was being, well, was rotting away. The other thing my friend did was to steal scraps of metal. And he put together little makeshift stoves for various corners of the camp, and with stolen pieces of wood we made fires. The kitchen staff occasionally allowed us to take some potato peelings, and so by now we had one or two metal stoves and we could make some extra food, baking potato peelings. The work in the camp was of two sorts. The factory made anti-aircraft guns. Not only that, my own experience was with anti-aircraft guns. The arsenal, the Ostmarkwerke, was, we were told, the last of the factories, German ammunition factories, as the war had squeezed Germany from the west and the right, west and the east. And this factory remained functional until something like January 1945. The factory itself was built underground. The factory buildings were camouflaged by grass and bushes on the top. All single-floor buildings, with the sole exception of a 19th century residue, one building, this five-floor old factory building in which the Jewish camp was. By January 1945, all of the camouflaged low buildings had been hit, and most of them destroyed by bombs. And the one building that never had a direct hit was this five-floor building standing in the middle. I must tell you, there are so many minor miracles in my experience and in the experience of a lot of the people that told me their, or told us their life stories after the end of the war. And I remarked to my father, listening to some of these stories, these people are telling tall tales. And unusually for my father, he admonished me, saying, yes, they tell tall tales, because unless they have tall tales to tell, they wouldn't be here to tell any tales at all. I have a few tall tales of my own, and one of them was that for some reason our building remained intact throughout the war, while the Ostmarkwerke became more and more of the prominent targets of bombing. I experienced for the first time that official status, education, and age are no guides to humanity. Some of the heroes of the camp life were the youngest or the simplest or the frailest, apparently, such as my 13-year-old friend and my old grandmother. And some of the people who behaved in the most inhuman ways were the elders of the community, the highly regarded members. There was a judge who behaved unseemingly, and particularly there was a very famous doctor of medicine, a professor of medicine, who was with us in the camps. And he would not attend the sick unless you gave him a quantity of food rations that you couldn't afford to give. On one occasion, my father, whose eyesight was not very good, had an accident. The factory was poorly lit because there was a bomb hitting the electrical supplies, and there was a kind of trap door through the floor, and the trap door was open, and he didn't notice it, and he fell down, and he fell a floor's height. He suffered concussion and lost his memory. He was for a while unconscious. Then he came to, but like I said, he didn't know where he was or who he was, didn't recognize any of us. It was alarming. And Professor Gesty, the famous professor of medicine, wouldn't come to see my father because, like I told you, there were 11 of us for 6 food rations. We didn't have any spares. And he wouldn't, and he didn't. It did teach me these experiences. You know, they teach you lessons. They teach you lessons, like I said, that possessions don't amount to much, but family does. And that social status doesn't amount to much. But there is something deeper inside people which determines their value in human society. Anyhow, the work we did was of two sorts. I mentioned this. People who were older, like my mother and my aunts and my father, they worked on machinery, factory machinery, manufacturing parts for anti-aircraft guns and other weapons. We children, this is the so-called 14-year-old gang, 14-plus-year-old gang of children, we had the job. It sounds crazy, but this is confirmed, and it will be told to you if you meet up with one of the people who was in the same camp. It will be confirmed. It sounds crazy. It was arranged such that the anti-aircraft gun, which was mounted on one enormous board, cast iron board, arrived in pieces at the foot of the 5-floor factory building in which we lived. So there was this huge casting, weighing, we now estimate, about 50 kilograms. And then the various bits and pieces. And this whole lot had to be taken to the top floor of this building by foot, it had to be carried up on the staircase. On the top floor was the assembly floor, and they put it all together. All the parts were mounted on this casting, and then the whole assembly had to be carried down. By now, I don't know how much it would have weighed, down the same staircase to be taken away.
Who put it together?
Austrian workers. Some of them were Czech workers. These were skilled workers. And the Jewish children's job it was to take the parts up to the 5th floor and carry the parts down from the 5th floor. And this on a, I think this was by then a 10-hour working day. I don't think I need to tell you more about it. The difficulty was that sometimes somebody lost the grip. And if the person who lost the grip was further up on the staircase, then the one who was below was hit by the piece and rolled down the staircase. These kinds of accidents happened not often, but sometimes. There was one boy who was much stronger than we were, and he was spirited and kind, and he always made sure that he was the one who was on the lower part, because he could bear the thing better than we could. And if he could have carried the whole thing up by himself, he would have done. And if a girl had him for a partner, that meant an easy day that day, because he did more than his fair share. Stephen, by his name. Stephen Hoffman. But quite often I was paired with one of my particular friends, who was also 13. He became a professor of literature in later life. He was a phenomenal person with a memory like I haven't met often. And he knew the whole of the map of Europe to the minutest detail. And he was a tremendously important person in the camp, because somebody would hear the name of a village, the name of a river somewhere, to do with the passage of the war on the Russian front, in Africa, in Western Europe, wherever. And so you would immediately rush to Andrew and ask him where this might be, and he would know where it is, and he could sketch the map for you, and with his aid you could follow the passage of the war. But to have him as your partner to carry up and down the anti-aircraft gun was always a tragedy, because he had two left feet, he was an intellectual, he was not muscular, and he was clumsy. And, well, this was our work in the camp. We were unfortunate. My family had we realized what having a family of 11 declared as one family of 11 meant, we would perhaps have declared ourselves as lots of smaller families under different names. But when it came to anything being distributed, people thought that it was too big a pile, and we never really got 11 pieces of whatsoever it was, but always we were always shortchanged. I was mandated by the family to take the food container as an example, to take the food container to the food distribution place. The food container was a blue enameled pot with a handle. And so I took the container, and the person distributing, the Jewish woman distributing the food, would start counting 1, 2, and by the time it is 3, she was making the rations a bit smaller, the ladles a bit less full, and by the time it got to 5, it was only half full, and quite often I didn't have the 6th ladle full at all, because it looked too much. Why should she give such a quantity of food to one person? And I tried to argue, but this is, I'm the one person taking it away, but there are 6 rations here to be had, to be distributed among 11. But never did I get the full quantity. Anyhow, the factory was gradually destroyed until it came by January to be in such a state that it couldn't function. Then came a very interesting part of our life. which lasted for a few weeks, and it was very productive in one sense, and a totally useless thing in another sense. We were taken by lorry to the center of Vienna to clear the bomb damage. One of the places that everybody visits in Vienna is the Stephanskirche, beautiful Gothic church. Well, I can claim that I was one of the people who wheeled in wheelbarrows some of the rubble which had been created by bomb damage of Stephanskirche and its districts and the Habsburg palaces and whatever. So we went from place to place. But I think that the war was gaining on us. The bomb damage was created more quickly than we could clear it away. So in that sense, it was a useless venture, and soon the Austrians realized this. And so this period came to an end. It was extremely profitable, though, as far as I was concerned, because they couldn't really guard us very effectively. And I soon discovered that Austrian housewives were carrying shopping home. They didn't have too much, but sometimes they found a bread shop having a few loaves of bread, so they bought as much as they could, because who knows when the next loaf of bread might come from. And so there were these women carrying heavy shopping, and I could sneak up to them and say, "May I help you to carry your luggage and your shopping?" And some said, "Yes, why not?" And the guards were either not vigilant enough, or they were willing to turn a blind eye. So there was I carrying up the homes, the shopping for these women, and likely as not they gave you a piece of bread or a potato. And there was one, sometimes they even gave you a little part of a cooked meal, and they wrapped it up in paper and newspaper, and these were fantastic. There was one particular occasion that I remember. A woman said, just finished cooking spetzels. This is a kind of pasta dish, very good, and it's still hot, and sit down and have some. And I said, "No, thank you very much, I am not hungry, I'd like to take it with me." And she said, "How can you say you are not hungry? Obviously you are hungry, come and sit down." Then I started to say, "But I have a baby cousin and I want to take it to her." And she was by then being her commandeering self, and she demanded that I sit, and she forced me practically to try to eat. "Have you tried to eat when you are sobbing? It's not very easy." But there was I eating my spetzels, because she wouldn't allow me otherwise. I'm sure she was well-intentioned, but she didn't have the sensitivity to give me a piece of bread as well as having force-fed me the spetzels. Anyhow, this period, which was interesting, soon came to an end, because it was pointless, because the war was being lost. And then we were packed off again and taken back to Strasshof, which was the camp, holding camp, that we had started off from. My father, who had been educated in a monastery school by Catholic priests, educated to the extent that they were taught history in Latin and geometry in Greek. So for him, these ancient languages were not a matter of study in themselves only, they were also a vehicle for communication. Now my father made friends with some Italian prisoners.